No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIOPR. Tonight we have a very, very special guest, but first let me just send out a thank you to Representative Steny Hoyer from Maryland, who has signed on to our statehood bill. We now have 205 co-sponsors in the House of Representatives, 32 in the Senate, and Elijah Cummings has just announced that he will have a hearing on the bill July 24th, and hopefully we'll get it to a floor vote, and that's very exciting news for us in the statehood movement. But even
and
more,
but also, Michael, this is your unprecedented in the numbers.
Yes. More than ever before.
And but California still ranks as one.
California is still number one. God bless the people of California. Without delay, let's get our special guests on tonight.
Yes.
Tonight we have Ralph Nader, lawyer, consumer advocate, environmentalist, author of more than two dozen books, two-time Nieman Fellow, Gandhi Peace Award recipient, Horchow Award for Public Service, Automotive Hall of Fame, repeatedly named 100 most influential Americans by Lifetime in Atlantic Magazine. And if I had to do his whole resume, we wouldn't have enough time on the show. Just an amazing person, a local hero in Washington, D.C. Mr. Nader, welcome to the show, and thanks so much for being on.
Oh, you're very welcome. Good to be on.
The last time I saw you was at a thing that you did at Constitution Hall called Breaking Through Power.
So
let's start there since we're both statehood advocates. You at that conference, you said we needed $20 million over 2 years to make this a reality. And I certainly agree with that. But we've only spent less than $1 million in that period of time. What are we doing wrong, in your opinion?
Well, the real fight is going to be in a few congressional districts that have to be turned around to get the House of Representatives a good majority. And, of course, the Senate. The Senate needs three dozen or so more senators to take it over the top. And the only way you do that is to go into the states themselves and the districts. And to do that, you need full-time organizers. You need facilities. You need expense. And there are people in the district, and I've discussed this with Mark Plotkin, who is also at the Constitution Hall extravaganza, I'll comment some in a moment. And I said, you know, Mark, there are very rich people here in the district. And you would think that one or two of them or three of them would want to be considered the parents of the 51st state, Columbia. Sure.
Yeah,
I mean, that's a pretty good thing to end your resume with. Mm-hmm. If you're retired and you've got tons of money, you don't know what to do with it. And I think that's where the failure is, that we haven't systematically tried to find these people. Some of them, their names are well known. Many of them, nobody knows about at all. They're up in Northwest Washington, and they're sitting on tens of millions of dollars each. So that's what's needed. And the same is for massive demonstrations around Congress. I mean, really big ones, with bullhorns coming back day after day, coordinating with members of Congress in terms of hearings, having them speak. You know, it's a pretty irrebuttable argument, right? I mean, this is the only capital of any government around that doesn't give its people a vote. Even in authoritarian regimes, you go to the capital city, and if they do have elections, they get the vote.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
There's a concept. I, you know, coming in from the outside, Mr. Nader, because I'm in California, since I've known the senator, which is, we're going on 3 years now together on the program, I just don't understand why it's a no-brainer. But I hear what you're saying about the logistics and the money and the boots on the ground. That makes sense to me. But the outrage seems to have subsided, and I think that's just because of saturation.
Well, you know, Maria, it's also a strange situation here. And I've said this, and Senator Brown knows this. The biggest event for D.C. statehood was the one we put on in September 29th or 28th, 2016, at the Constitutional Hall. I mean, you couldn't get a more historic venue. It has about like 3,300 seats. And we put posters up all over the district. We tried to get the media to anticipate and announce it. It was very difficult to get WTOP and others to announce something like this, even though they're always announcing if some new chain store opens or some new product is put on the market. And we ended up with maybe 300 people in the audience.
Oh, my gosh.
And it got virtually no coverage. Even Kojo Nami, you know, Senator Brown, he wouldn't even cover it.
And, which is amazing.
Public radio, NPR, PBS, the local television. It's like it was the number one issue in the district. 71% of the people, even without a campaign, want D.C. statehood. 71%. And look at the lineup at the Constitution Hall. I mean, we had members of the D.C. City Council, like Phil Mendelson. We had Representative Eleanor Holmes Norton. We had Mark Plotkin. We had Senator Brown. We had the D.C. Representative Franklin Garcia. We had former Mayor Anthony Williams, who was the director of the powerful Federal City Council, so you had the power structure there. We had Reverend Graylin Hagler. We had Scott McLarty of the Greens. We had Congressman John Conyers was coming, but he had to cancel. He had some emergency. We had the D.C. General Counsel, Betsy Cavendish. We had the expert on it, the constitutional law expert, Alan Morrison, professor of law, George Washington School of Law. I spoke, and I still didn't pull off. We couldn't get the mayor, Bowser. You know, you get into a cab in the D.C., and you hear her recorded announcement pressing for D.C. statehood, but she wouldn't come down Constitution Avenue from the D.C. government to open up the whole session. Now, so there must be some turf problem with some of the other politicians who were on the stage that day. But you couldn't get 500 people in a demonstration for statehood. And, you know, people in Congress, they're quick to accentuate the negative. And so they know that the people of the district seem a majority, vast majority of them, they may be answering the polls, yes, D.C. statehood, but they won't come out and rally in March.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I liken it sometimes to the fact that when I grew up, I had a friend whose father was a child psychologist, and his children were the worst people in the neighborhood, were the worst kids in the neighborhood, you know, and that's kind of how D.C. is. I think if you took the voting rights away from the people of Wisconsin, we could get more people out into the street to protest that, than we do for ourselves. And
Jesse Jackson had the same problem. You remember, he was shadow senator.
Yes.
And he had a rally in front of the White House, but he told me it was like pulling teeth to get a few hundred people out, you know.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. You see, they and then also I was with the D.C. mayor, and we were down near the D.C. government building. We had a big rally when there was the Occupy Wall Street movement was underway, and Dick Gregory was there. And but I think it has to start with really bigger and bigger mass demonstrations, bringing in people from neighboring states, so that excuse is gone forever. You don't hear people say, "Well, you know, people in the district don't even turn out. What do you expect us to do?"
Yeah, it's a real problem. So, any chance we can get you? We can try to strong arm Elijah Cummings and get you to testify at our hearing when we have a hearing.
I'd love to do that. If you can pull that off, I'd really love to do that. July 24th.
Yep.
And I mean, you know, I fought. You're going to love this one. I fought for Alaska and Hawaii statehood when I was 22. I came down after I was in law school, and I couldn't wait to hitchhike to Washington from New England in order to do my bet for Alaska and Hawaii statehood. There's a lot of racism involved. I remember there was a senator on the floor. He was opposed to Hawaii statehood, and he said something like, "You imagine having a senator whose name is Wong?"
Oh, no, really?
Can you imagine? Yeah. And then nobody raised any, you know, they just sort of brushed him off. But today he'd be in pretty hot water. But there, then I wanted statehood when I was at university at Princeton. I wanted statehood and actually went down to Puerto Rico because there's no reason why Puerto Rico is marginalized as a commonwealth. Mm-hmm. Here's the problem, as everybody knows. The Republicans don't want two more Democratic senators.
Right.
They want it, they don't want another Democratic representative. And the same with Puerto Rico. I mean, they're going to send two Democratic senators and one Republican. The big failure was 2009, as you know, Senator Brown.
Right.
Obama had a huge majority in the Congress, and he was riding a high tide. And it was very low on his priority list. That was the time to really make it happen, right?
Right. And, you know, and it gets back to exactly what you just said, that, you know, if I was an Obama advisor, I would have said to him, look, they can't get 500 people to come to a rally. Don't get in the middle of it. You know, don't, there's an old political saying, don't poke a skunk. You know, don't get in the middle of this, right? Because these guys don't even care about it. So that was our opportunity, and we did.
By the way, anybody wants to watch the proceedings at Constitution Hall, they're up on the internet. You just go to breakingthroughpower.org, and you'll see it all. See all the speakers and so on. And you'll also see a lot of other days. It was the greatest gathering of more civic leaders, the greatest gathering of more civic leaders, more civic doers, and more civic thinkers from around the country on more reforms, redirections, and improvements ever brought together in one location in American history. And the press blacked it out.
Yeah, it's just amazing.
What's that reason, do you think? Does it speak to the apathy that I was talking about, that even they, too, don't see it as news?
One is it was Trump time, you remember, the summer of 2016? Yeah. He sucked up a lot of it. That's one reason, not the only reason. The other reason is they don't know how to cover what we call the Super Bowl of citizen action. They just don't know how to cover it. The New York Times sent Nick Fandos, young reporter. He just looked around all these speakers. He didn't know how to select out the human interest. There was the disability rights leader, Ralph Hotchkiss, who completely revolutionized wheelchair design and construction all over the world, broke the monopoly in England, the Jennings Corporation, with bad, expensive, fragile wheelchairs. And he showed right on the stage how he couldn't even break his wheelchair. He's a paraplegic. And that was, I said to the managing editor of the Washington Post, you know, that's a great story. I mean, there are a lot of interesting stories, but they just aren't. they're not covering the civic community. The progressive citizen groups have never been shut out more by the mass media since I came to Washington in the early 1960s. And I've tried to make that point again and again. And I must say, the citizen groups are not aggressive enough. The right wing, when they get shut out, they raise havoc, right? But our side sort of just rolls with the punches.
Well, and that's part of our problem, too, isn't it, in Washington, that we're somewhat co-opted because we, you know, we rely, especially our government officials, because we rely on the federal government, and then we go up there and we fight with the federal government to give us our rights, but we feel like we really need to be polite about it, right? Because we don't want to annoy them. I mean, it's really a double-edged sword for us. And also, I think that the government people in D.C., the mayor and the city council, they really don't get anything out of statehood. You know, they still have a $15.5 billion budget. They, you know, it's the people of the District of Columbia that get something out of statehood. So I think it's not high on their priority list as it should be. They talk the talk, but I don't think they walk the walk sometimes. But
yeah, with few exceptions, obviously.
Yeah, a few exceptions, sure.
What's interesting is when you tell people outside the district, you know, in Missouri and California and elsewhere, do you know the District of Columbia, they don't have control over their own budget. It can be overturned. Mm-hmm. That if they have a referendum and the referendum wins on a certain issue, can be overturned by Congress. You know, you got two congressional committees run by people 1,000 miles away from, you know, Mississippi or whatever, and they are the final rulers, which is really pretty outrageous. Imagine the kids in the schools in the district being told about democracy. I said, I mean, there's some dramatic things that can be done. We should put signs on the Maryland and Virginia border, big signs, "Welcome to the D.C. colony."
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I thought at one time I wanted to put up a sign that looked like the warning signs that you see in airports and other places that say, warning, relocating to the District of Columbia may result in the revocation of your basic civil rights something like that. You know, because they always say that, you know, that's one of the things they say when they oppose us. Oh, you knew it wasn't a state when you moved here. Well,
yeah.
A lot of us didn't know
Maria,
that.
The closest thing is, you probably know, Maria, that the cars have the license plate, you know. They have a license plate, no representation, no taxation without representation. That's about as close as it gets.
But there
is a lot of lip service, isn't there?
Right. There's a lot of lip service. But, well, thank you for that insight. And we'll see what we can do about pushing you you'd be an amazing.
That would be fantastic.
Yes, it really would. But let's talk a little bit about your advocacy and how that's changed, because you brought that up, how advocacy has changed. You know, we all know that unsafe at any speed changed everything, right? It changed everything. It led to a whole a genre of consumer activism that has changed so many things.
Well, and congressional hearings and then the automobile safety laws.
Yeah.
I mean, did you have any idea, Mr. Nader, that when you published that book, and I guess you were like in your early 30s, that it was going to have that kind of reverberation?
Yeah, it might have been hope over reality, but I was a real bulldog. And, you know, I'd lost some friends and high school and college and on traffic crashes, which today would be totally survivable because there's seat belts and airbags and padded dash panels and so on and so forth. And some of my friends were paraplegics for life. I recommended, I dedicated my book on safety and speed to Fred Condon, who became a paraplegic because he just slightly fell asleep at the wheel coming back from his job to his home, and the car flipped, and he was half in, half out. There were no seatbelts at that time. He had wife and four children, and he, a very valiant young man, and I was driven by that. I wasn't just driven by knowledge of the auto companies refusing to put these decades-long safety systems in cars and improve the braking and the handling. I was driven by the memory of my friends, and you know, that makes you think you're going to do the impossible. I remember once I was hitchhiking back from Connecticut down. I didn't have any money to take a bus. I was hitchhiking down, and I was let off in Delaware, and a truck driver picked me up. And he said, where are you going? I said, well, I'm going to Washington, D.C. And he said, what for? And I said, well, I'm going to regulate General Motors. He starts rolling his eyes. I thought he was going to pull over the side of the road and let me out. But that's the kind of fervor that was required. I also was lucky because one of the senators was my senator from Connecticut, Senator Ribicoff, who made a big deal out of traffic safety when he was governor of Connecticut. And that's what the first subcommittee hearing was. And GM made the mistake of hiring private detectives to trail me around the country. And they got caught in the Senate office building by the Senate Capitol Police. And that unraveled the whole thing and led to highly publicized hearings. And just like that, Lyndon Johnson signed this highway and auto safety laws in September of 1966. I mean, you got things done in the old days. I mean, you couldn't even get a hearing today. That's how bad it is, because the people forgot their sovereignty, you know, we the people, and to keep control over the Congress. They let the money bags control the Congress. And I don't think to this day people understand that the greatest lever to turn our country around on just about everything, on poverty, on environment, on labor, on foreign military policy, is the Congress. It's the most powerful branch of government. It has to be the smallest, and we all know their names. There's only 535 of them, for heaven's sake. And we're millions out there. And if we just organize Congress watchdog groups, as I've been recommending for years, and summon the members to regular town meetings, not town meetings choreographed by the senators and representatives, but town meetings planned in terms of agenda by the people back home, then we could really change things very, very rapidly. Mm-hmm. But I was driven to write a fable a few months ago called How the Rats Reformed the Congress. You know, there's a rat infestation, as Senator Brown knows, in D.C.
Yeah. Big bust up on Capitol Hill, too, really.
So we gave a Callaway Award for moral courage to the workers in the catacombs under the Congress because they're exposed to heat and dust and asbestos. It's so dangerous under the Congress that they won't even let senators and representatives go down there. And so that gave me the idea to start this fable on how the rats, doing what rats do, they looking for food and water, and there are a lot of crumbs around from parties on Capitol Hill, and they went up to toilet bowls. You can imagine what happened, right? Well, yes. Anyway, that alerted citizen groups around the country, say, wow, it's all over the TV. There's mass derision. Now's the time when people are paying attention and laughing at Congress to organize. And the rest of the book is very practical on what it takes to organize to take back Congress. And everything that's in that book, nobody can stop the American people from doing. Nobody. And you want to see what it's like, go to ratsreformcongress.org. It's called ratsreformcongress.org. And there's an instruction section as to how to start a Congress Rat Watchers group in your congressional district. You know, I learned that if you make people laugh themselves seriously, you might get them to do something. If you're too somber, you know, they get sort of overwhelmed or they get a sense of tediousness. So there's a lot of fun in this book. We distributed it down around Congress. They were not amused, shall we say?
Yeah, I guess not. Well, before I say anything else, let me tell you that I am one of the many Americans that is in your debt because I drove a 1972 Ford Pinto when I was in college. They put a little plastic shield in the back, and I was in a rear-end collision, which totaled the car, and I walked away from it. And it's because of work of you and others that I truly believe that I was able to do that. So thank you. And I also want to tell you that Eleanor Holmes Norton said to me, and the first time I met with her, nothing is ever generated from inside the walls of Congress. It all comes from pressure from the outside. So what you're saying about organizing and putting pressure on Congress is so important. And I'm not exactly sure why we don't get that sometimes. You know, we have a caller. Bonnie's called in with a question. Can we get her on the air? I think she wants to ask Mr. Nader something. Bonnie, are you there?
I am here.
Okay, what's your question?
Mr. Nader, you know, I have always been a total fan of yours because of how you care about the country. And I want to know how in the heck we get rid of this frigging president that we've got right now.
What a shame, huh? I mean, it's almost beyond belief. I wrote an article, one of many, but in this article I said he's the most impeachable president in American history by a thousand miles. I mean, just look, it's not just obstruction of justice. It's not just his foul mouth, his bigotry, his misogyny, his lies that bring ill repute to the office of the president, which was considered an impeachable offense by our founding fathers, by the way. It's that he has systematically shut down the life-saving programs from the Environmental Protection Agency, from the Auto Safety Agency. The FAA is a joke. The whole Boeing disaster with the killer 737-800 MAX is just one example. He has taken apart law enforcement. He's taken the federal cop off the corporate beat, and he stripped away protections for small children. He thinks that coal is clean and beautiful. I mean, you got to be nuts, you know, to think that. I mean, I worked on the coal miners' health and safety bill, and 400,000 Americans at least have died for their coal mine owners since 1890. Black lung disease, that's the coal dust destroying the lungs of the mine workers, as well as the collapse of the shafts and the so-called accidents. He's cut Medicare for kids. They're cutting the nutrition program for poor kids. Now, the president, when he swears in, he swears to faithfully execute the laws. It's right out of the Constitution. And he has exactly done the opposite. Massively, systematically, openly, brazenly, proudly. And he puts in charge of these agencies people whose only skill is that they have a record of trying to destroy the agency that they were nominated to head.
I have lived all over the world, and I cannot believe that we have a person that is the president of the United States that can try to destroy us.
Yeah,
yeah, making America dread again. look, the problem is he was never elected. He was selected by the terrible Electoral College. The Democratic Party's lost two elections in 16 years. Even though they won the popular vote, they lost the Electoral College. And they still won't join a citizen drive that's already halfway there to neutralize the Electoral College by getting state laws, and Maryland started it, and Illinois, New York, California, Connecticut, that basically say that once we, the states, reach a total of 270 electoral college votes, we'll give our electoral college votes to whoever wins the national popular vote. So that would be goodbye electoral college. And the Democratic Party won't even join it.
Well,
why in the heck do we have an electoral college, you know? We should try to have people vote for people that are better than this pig asshole that we've got right now.
Thanks so much for calling in, Bonnie. Go ahead, Ralph.
Yeah, I was going to say, the Democratic Party still doesn't really have a strategy. He is so outrageous, they can't grasp it. It's like, you know,
Well, Michael said
they don't even have the language. For example, he has all these dirty nicknames that he gives everybody, right?
Right.
And the press routinely repeats it. Like he's got his own media, even the New York Times, Washington Post, you know, Crooked Hillary, Lying Ted, and now he's after Biden, he's after Crazy Bernie. And I keep telling these editors, you know, you're really performing in a very unprofessional manner. If you're going to repeat those nicknames, then you should give the victim of the nickname a right of reply. Well, one way to respond to the nicknames is to give Trump nicknames. There's nothing better than a bully getting his own verbal medicine. So, draft-dodging Donald, cheating Donald, dangerous Donald, corrupt Donald, you know, pick your nickname. But those nicknames did devastating effect. They have devastating effect on what I call the five-minute voter. You know, the voter just thinks about the image, whether he likes the person running, the slogans, and often that's enough to turn the election in a close election.
Well, you know, you said this about the Electoral College and the fact that the Democrats are unwilling to get behind it. As somebody who has been a Democrat, an independent, a Green Party person, a Republican, a member of the Populist Party and of Maryland and the Vermont Progressive Party, do you think the Democrats are going to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory once again because they have 24 now candidates? What do you think about that in the primary? As somebody that's been a third-party candidate, what do you think about the fact that we're going into this primary with 24 candidates? Isn't that crazy?
Well, you know, I've always supported as many voices as choices in the electoral arena. Mm-hmm. So I don't mind that at all. And they're not really going after each other. That would demean
they
all, you know, went after each other, and then they would all sort of sink each other. So far, they're behaving civilly. And then let a lot of ideas float around, because one candidate cannot float 20, 30 policy ideas. The press just won't give that candidate that kind of elbow. But if they all have different ideas and see which ones catch on, I think by January, there probably won't be more than six left.
Well, let's hope that's true, because, you know, I worked on the campaign of what they call the Seven Dwarfs. I don't know if you remember this, but it was Dukakis and Gephardt and Jesse Jackson and Gary Hart and all these people. And in the end, I think we ended up with a great guy that wasn't very electable. That's what I worry about.
That's the hazard. I think there are three ways the Democrats can win. One, Trump beats himself. I mean, you never know when he finally crosses a line on some things. He just beats himself. He immolates himself with his behavior or whatever. The second is, if the Democrats know how to degrade him based on his awful record, and based on what he's doing to the children in America. Just think how many children are sassing their parents when their parents say, stop doing that, and the 9 or 10-year-olds say, well, President Trump does that. President Trump uses that language. Just think of that in terms of degrading the civility right down to the family level. But in the third way, and this is what is necessary, that there's an independent citizen get-out-the-vote drive. So getting out 10 million non-voters in 13 key states, and I say independent because the Democrats don't know how to get out the vote. I mean, that was obvious from 2016. Hillary Clinton had $1 billion, and she didn't know what to do with it. She was ripped off by all those consultants and all those foolish TV ads, and she didn't get out to vote in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Illinois, Wisconsin, and Ohio. So there needs to be a parallel citizen movement, no connection with the Democrats, to be, you know, silenced or compromised, and just working in all these areas where low-income people have been so depressed, so disenfranchised, that they just haven't voted. And you start this process in July, well before November, and you have discussions and meetings, and you respect them, and you see what their needs are. One issue alone, introduced by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, would have defeated the Republicans in the House, Senate, and the presidency in the last couple of decades, and that's minimum wage. 30 million people were making less in adjusted inflation minimum wage in 2010, 2012, 2014 than workers made in 1968. And so you could have said to these workers, you're being cheated by inflation. The bosses are making more money for sure than they did in 1968. The profits are higher in Walmart in 1968. So go vote for a raise. Think of that as a slogan. Vote for a raise. You've earned it. You've been denied it. And it's time for you to get it. Now, can you imagine? Why wouldn't the Democratic Party do that? Because they're raising money the same way the Republicans are, from the corporate interests.
Well, and also, you know, we have this problem, I think, as Democrats, where we talk down to America. I mean, Hillary went to Utah. They haven't voted for a Democrat in Utah since Lyndon Johnson, but she didn't go to Wisconsin in the end. You know,
Milwaukee.
We have this feeling that we know better than the, you know, we just become pompous somehow. And I don't know how that happened, because we used to be the party of the people.
It's dialing for the same commercial dollars.
Yeah.
And going into these fat cat fundraisers, you know, they go to California to go to Beverly Hills for a fundraiser. They never go to South Central Los Angeles. They don't mix with the workers in the San Joaquin Valley. Now, I mean, they brought it on themselves, but the problem is they brought the country down with them.
Yeah, and that wasn't true when I started. I mean, I've been doing this for 40 years, and I was much more involved as a foot soldier with the Democratic Party when I was at the DNC, and going to union events and organizing people in neighborhoods than they do now. I think you're exactly right about that.
Imagine losing, Senator Brown, imagine losing 40% of the union vote.
Right.
I mean, the union leaders are responsible for this, too. I don't give them a pass.
Yeah.
But you couldn't have a more anti-worker in 100 ways party than the Republican Party. And they got a 35-40% of the blue-collar vote. Because when was the last time you saw a labor leader outside addressing 50,000 workers, like in the 30s and 40s?
Right.
You know?
Right.
They've lost touch.
Yeah, and it's amazing. It's amazing to me. You know, I was a Teamster, and when I run, I was a Teamster for about 2 years when I was a young man. And when I run, it's the first thing I say. It's the first thing I stand up and say, you know, especially if I'm talking to working people. The union was the first. It was the first sick leave I ever got. It was the first day I ever got off. It was the first Christmas bonus I ever got. Was working for the union. So, and I think we really, really have lost that. So have you given up your, are you going to run for president again? You've done it a few times now.
2008 was the last one. And completely blacked out by the press. Completely.
Yeah.
Couldn't get on the debates. Poll after poll in 2004, and wanted me on the debates. And if you don't get on debates, you can't reach anybody. In 2000, I filled the huge arenas all over the country, like Madison Square Garden.
Yeah.
And I only reached 2% of the people I could have reached had I been on one of the debates, one of the three debates. But, you know, the only time the press was interested to ask if I was going to be a spoiler, I said, how do you be a spoiler of a spoiled, rotten political system we're trying to clean up? You tell me that? You know, no other country in the world makes it harder for third-party candidates to get on the ballot. Mm-hmm. No other Western country in the world. You wouldn't believe how hard it is to get on states like Georgia, Texas, California, even 140,000 signatures, which means you got to get 280, usually double, because they can disqualify and eligibility and so on. and Georgia was just impossible, Oklahoma, impossible. On the other hand, you know, in Canada, you can run for the parliament in Ottawa for like $50 fee and less than a couple hundred signatures.
So do you think that you think we're going to have a strong third party growing in America? I mean, I don't know the numbers of the Green Party these days, but you think there's room for a third party, or will people just become independent, you think, and disavow themselves from both parties?
Given all the barriers and the Electoral College, it's hard to see a third party rising from a mass movement anytime soon. But it's not hard to see a third party rising from a billionaire. Like Ross Perot got 19 mm-hmm. million votes in 1992. Mm-hmm. Remember the Reform Party?
Yeah.
He didn't get a single Electoral College vote. Not one.
That's amazing.
Did you see the barriers? And that's one reason why Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York, didn't want to run in 2016 on a third party, because he just couldn't see surmounting the Electoral College vote. Much less, you know, all the other obstacles. To me, you know, getting candidates on the ballot is a way to make your vote more meaningful, because you have more voices and choices. It's not just candidate rights. Candidate rights affect voter rights. And a lot of reason why people don't vote is because of gerrymandering. They just see one person on the ballot, he's going to win, it's all rigged. Or the two presidential candidates don't mean anything to them. They don't speak to their needs. That's what you see when the polls, the people say, why didn't you vote? Well, you say, because didn't make, what difference did it make? That's so, I mean, I think it does make a difference, obviously.
Right.
But you got to get people's attention.
We have in California the decline to state. I don't know how prevalent that is in the rest of the country, that is gaining more share of the market than people had thought. And now that we're able to vote in primaries, regardless of your affiliation, it seems to be gaining in popularity.
Well, I'd like to take it one step further, Maria, which is binding none of the above. Nevada has non-binding, none of the above, but if on every line, whether it's mayor or governor, you have a none of the above option, that is, you can go to the polls and say, no confidence in the candidates, I'm voting none of the above. And if none of the above wins, it cancels that election line, and they have to have a new election and new candidates in, say, 30 days. That is a good lesson to gerrymandering, especially because people are basically saying, the system is rigged, I don't want to have anything to do with it. And if it's binding, imagine if you're a candidate for office and your daughter in college 2,000 miles away can't wait to hear the result and calls up and says to Mommy, how did you do? Or Daddy, how did you do? And they have to say, well, Susan, I lost to none of the above.
Well, that
but California has a terrible top two. Because that just destroys third parties going to November, right, Maria?
Yes. Yes, it does.
Tell the people of the District of Columbia that one.
Yeah.
Well, and you know what? I often say to young people when I'm out there who say, why should I vote? It doesn't matter. That, you know, when I was at the DNC, we used to look at voter participation, and we would put our efforts into Social Security because old people voted. And neglect things like education because young people didn't vote. You know, so every time you don't vote, you're hurting everybody in your social class. If you want Congress to do something, you want the president to do something, you have to know, he has to know you're out there. They have to know you're out there. But can we just take a moment and you tell me if what's going on with Boeing Airlines? I know that you lost your grandniece, and you have our deepest condolences in the Ethiopian airline crash. What's going on with the 737 MAX? Are they I think I heard a quote from you where you said it's not a software problem, it's a design problem.
That's right. took the lives of 346 people in Indonesia and Ethiopia, including my great-grandniece, who was a rising star in global health, wanted to work in Africa at the village level, and was on her first assignment. And she had compassion, intellectual rigor, great leadership quality, just what you want from millennials.
Right.
And she's gone. And we have to, and the whole extended family is now on a mission to bring Boeing to justice, to get the FAA to be a regulator instead of a delegator by supporting legislation that's going to be introduced in Congress by Senator Blumenthal from Connecticut and others, and by trying to make sure that the Boeing 737 MAX never flies again. Because, as you pointed out, there is no software mix that's needed for the Boeing 737-800NG because it doesn't have heavy engines like the MAX that destabilize the center of gravity and make it prone to stall in midair. And so the FAA and Boeing, it's like Siamese twins, they want to put all the attention on the software without full disclosure, by the way. And the original software that Boeing put in the plane, they never communicated it to the pilots or the airlines. In the Indonesian class, they didn't even know what was pushing the nose down 21 times before this mysterious software overpowered the pilots, took the plane's control from the pilots, and dove it into the sea. Imagine that.
Yeah.
That's a criminal act. And so they covered up. They distorted. They want to save money. They only had one sensor. The Boeing 737 MAX has one sensor, and it miscued to boot. I mean, it couldn't have been worse. And they did all this because they were trying to rush the plane to market and compete with the Airbus 320neo, which was taking orders away from them, from the airlines. And they didn't want to say that the pilots should be trained with this software because that would cost the airlines money and that would reduce the appeal of the Boeing 737-800 MAX. So it's the same old story, greed, power, secrecy, captured regulatory agency, the FAA, and there are now House representatives and the Senate hearings, but they're going too slowly because the FAA wants to get this plane up in a couple of months. And the foreign civil aviation counterparts, the FAA, are much more skeptical. And maybe they will hold out and keep the FAA from endangering the skies. Eleanor Holmes Norton, by the way, she's on the House Transportation Subcommittee on Aviation. I've talked to her about it. And she's got a lot of questions to ask the FAA. We have buttons that say axe the MAX. We want a consumer boycott spreading throughout the country. That'll get the airlines' attention more than anything, because my suspicion is that the House and Senate committees are slowing down, waiting for the FAA to put the planes up in the air. And, of course, that's then too late for any congressional leverage over the FAA and Boeing. But we have a Justice Department criminal probe with an operating grand jury underway looking into this, and they're already focusing on Boeing and the executives who overruled their own engineers in Boeing in order to rush this to market. And so the real problem is the design of the airplane that required the software, and you can't put the plane up with an unstable design and say, well, we've alerted the pilots. Good luck. No.
Yeah.
It's like you can't sell an unstable vehicle and hope that the drivers will know how to handle it on curbs.
That just doesn't make any sense logically. I mean, you wouldn't put any product out before it was proven to be effective and safe.
Exactly. Unless you own the government agency, which Boeing does.
Well, and how do we stop... You know, it seems to me that that's a kind of a natural symbiotic relationship develops between organizations like the FAA and manufacturers. They need each other. Is there anything we can do about that? Is there like a FOIA? Can we do a Freedom of Information Act kind of legislation where consumer advocates can get access to information?
Yeah. There are FOIAs that have been filed. There have been FOIAs filed on the Boeing 737-800 MAX as we speak to the FAA. Of course, the FAA can take its sweet time. But there's a group called Flyers' Rights, which came out of a group we started years ago, the Aviation Consumer Action Group. And that's the one you should contact, listeners. If you want to join an airline passenger group, that's the best one. There aren't that many to begin with. It's called Flyers' Rights. It's headed by Paul Hudson, who lost his daughter in the Lockerbie crash collision explosion over Scotland, 16-year-old daughter, 30 years ago. And so he's been doing his best for 30 years as a lawyer running this group. He's on one of the FAA advisory committees. And just go to Flyers Rights, FLYERSRIGHTS.
.org.
.org. Yeah. And he tells me that no matter how bad the situation is, airline passengers are about the hardest consumers to organize in the country.
I really don't get that. You would think as much as all of us fly that we would be way more concerned about it.
And it would be, as you imply, a political force, right? If you had 2-3 million people.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's because we see ourselves as individual, not as a collective. Because, I mean, you fly by yourself or with somebody else, and that's it. You kind of just blew my mind, because I've been doing a lot of traveling lately, and I thought, imagine collectively what that would be in terms of sheer numbers.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah, and also people are horrified to even think of the possibility of being in an airline crash. You know, and for 10 years, there's only been one fatality in the U.S. It's a terrific record until the Boeing MAX shook people up. And it's sort of something you don't want to think about. If you don't want to think about it, you don't want to join a group that makes you think about it. But this group, Flyers' Rights, is not only for safety. It deals with how airline passengers are being ripped off. You know, $200 for a reservation change, except for Southwest Airlines, which doesn't have these crazy baggage fees and, you know, charging you for everything but breathing, and crushing your knees and tight space. And, you know, United will charge you in a certain ticket you buy. They'll charge you to put a baggage on the bin above your seat. I mean, you know, they're going crazy with these computer stratifications of consumers, charging them fees, penalties. And Flyers' Rights works on that. It gives you a sense of what your rights are, which people don't realize. They do have some rights. And they've been pushing a passenger bill of rights that Eleanor Holmes Norton has supported in Congress. But, hey, you know, this will surprise our listeners. Why wouldn't members of Congress pass a passenger bill of rights for airline passengers? Don't they fly? Don't their staff fly? Here's the answer. I sent a survey last year, twice, to every member of Congress listing 15 freebies that airlines offer to members of Congress, but not to ordinary mortals like ourselves and airline passengers. And I said, please tell us which freebie have you accepted, like waiving reservation charges, right? Upgrade to first class, sometimes holding planes. Guess what? I sent it twice. I gave it to the media. Not a single response. Well, you know, when you're taking all these freebies, you're treated like a special king and queen by your airlines. You're going back to Missouri and Texas and Montana. You're going to do the airlines a favor. You're not going to pass a passenger bill of rights. See the corruption?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I've got to tell you, I was on a flight a couple of years ago, and I had a vacant seat in between me and another passenger, and a stewardess came up and said, we're going to have to stick a few bags here, like under your seat. And the guy next to me said, well, that's okay, but it'll be $50 for the first bag. And people applauded. People on the plane applauded, like, yeah, let's get back at them. So Ralph Nader, consumer advocate extraordinaire, statehood advocate, One of the most beloved people in Washington, D.C., I would dare say. Thank you for everything you've done. Thank you for being on our show. And we hope that you'll come back again sometime and visit us again, because you've been a fabulous guest. So thank you so much, Mr.
And Nader.org is a cornucopia of information.
Yeah. Oh, Maria, thank you for saying that. You can get my column free. Go to Nader.org. And just sign up. You get it automatically free every week. 7 minutes of creative agitation and solutions. And the Ralph Nader Radio Hour, it used to play on WPFW. Maybe if you call, you'll get it back on. And I interview people who really work hard for the people of this country and the world, but don't get any recognition. But they're really interesting to interview and hear what they're doing and saying and urging and thinking about. Yeah, I'm glad you're doing this, Senator Brown. Thank you also, Maria, about
thank
all
you.
This.
And you know what? I want you to do one personal favor for me. We have a mutual friend named Beverly Orr. I think Beverly used to be my accountant, so if you run into her, please say hello.
Oh, I will. She'll love to hear that.
Yeah. Okay, thanks again, Ralph Nader. We're going to leave you with the song that Mr. Nader and I are both old enough to remember. This is a rendition by Tracy Chapman, "The Times They Are Changing." Let's hope that's true. We'll see you next week. Maria, you want to say goodbye?
Just as always, we thank our listeners for making us a priority in your life. Hope you have a great week.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.